Hello and welcome back to the True Travel Podcast with me, Laura Sanders. This week was International Everest Day, and so I've got The Telegraph's Lucy Aspden on to talk about her recent trek to base camp. She hiked with none other than the son of Sherpa Tenzing, who was one of the first two men to summit Everest nearly 70 years ago. The trek to Everest has changed a lot since then, and Lucy tells us what it's really like to summit base camp in 2022. I also learn about life in the Himalayas and why so-called overnight mountaineers are ruining Everest, and how locals are cleaning up the mountains for future generations. If you're enjoying this podcast, then please subscribe, rate and review, as it helps others to discover it. Lucy, lovely to meet you. Thanks for coming on. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, very well.
Good, good. So before we get started on your Everest base camp expedition, just tell me a little bit about yourself. You know, how did you get into travel and what are you up to now?
So I am currently a commissioning editor on the travel desk at The Telegraph. And I've actually been at The Telegraph now for approaching 8 years. I started there fresh out of uni working on their ski and snowboard magazine as an intern. Seems a lifetime ago now. And that is kind of where it all began from for me. And since then, I've gone from doing ski to wider travel. And like you mentioned, I've just got back from probably the biggest trip of my life out to Everest Base Camp and the Himalayas.
Oh, amazing. So you're definitely a mountain person then by the sounds of it, skiing, snowboarding, and of course, reaching base camp now. Tell me a little bit about skiing then, because I'm a skier myself. Have you been to anywhere outside of Europe skiing?
Yeah, so started skiing when I was in high school with my family. Did it every year until I went to university. And like most people, the price of it then just becomes too much. And then I was really lucky in the job that at The Telegraph came up. They were looking for a passionate skier who also was training to be a journalist.
So brilliant.
That two worlds aligned. And ever since, I have been really lucky to go to some of the world's best ski resorts and travel in the mountains. And I am an outdoorsy person. Like, I've grown up in a family of outdoorsy people on holidays to the Lake District, camping in the south of France. So skiing has kind of been a passion of mine for many years. I try to get out to the mountains as much as possible. We've skied in Canada. I took my partner out there on his first ever ski holiday, and it's just, that was incredible. But then just going back to little resorts in the Alps that I've not been to for years, and going out for some big festivals. And yeah, I'm one of those weird people who looks forward to winter and is sad when everyone's getting like their bikinis out and I'm in bobble hats for as long as possible. So yes, try and spend as much time in the mountains as possible. And heading out to Nepal recently was my first time doing it not on skis, really. I'm more comfortable on skis than I am anything else, so it was quite a challenge and a change of scenery for us.
Oh, amazing. What would you say is the best ski resort you've visited so far?
So everyone always says to me, like, what's your favourite resort? They never really ask me the best, because I think the best ski resort is the one that you're in at the time. Like, it always is down to where you are and what you want on that day, and where's got good snow. If I have to choose a country, I love Austria, just for the cultural side of it, the authentic traditional nature. But then you can't beat France for some of the big mega resorts where you can just ski all day and not do the same run twice. But then again, yeah, we went to Canada and it was just the powder snow was just incredible. So it's wherever you are, whichever ski resort you're in, you can't complain. It's the best one at the time.
You can't really go wrong, can you? As long as you've got mountains and you've got the snow. I've not made it over to Canada, but I've done Chamonix in France a couple of times. That's a great resort. I'm sure you've been there. Austria as well, equally love, like you say, the cultural aspects. It's interesting that Canada, though, I've heard they don't really have the drink culture over there, do they? Like they do in the Alps. You know, Alps are very much après-ski and all of the partying after the skiing, whereas Canada, I feel like they're more serious skiers. Am I right?
Yeah, in North America, they have a completely different approach to the whole ski holiday experience, mainly because of the way the resorts are set up. So a lot of resorts in Canada or the US are built with like room-only accommodation. So you're self-catering, for want of a better word. So you are spending your evenings eating out. You don't have that catered chalet model, which is so popular in the Alps. And yeah, they have so many activities off the slope. So when we were in Canada, we went to like a nighttime spa, we went zip lining, snowshoeing. They're really big on making the most of your evenings rather than going and dancing on tables in your ski boots. And what's interesting is actually a lot of European resorts are trying to follow that trend now, especially since COVID. A lot of them are really trying to promote how to spend your time off the slopes that doesn't involve cramming yourself into a little hut to have drinks all night. So yeah, it's a different approach, but yeah, I like both sides of it. I don't mind a twilight spa. Who could complain?
Well, exactly. That sounds like a little bit of me. So tell us a little bit about Basecamp then. How did it come about? What made you want to do it? Was there much training involved?
So it was, again, the stars aligning to get us to Basecamp. So I was approached by a company called Tenzing, and they're a natural energy drink company who've launched in the past few years in the UK. And they were looking for someone to head out to trial this trip that they're launching. And they came across me, nothing to do with Telegraph. They didn't even know that I worked for the Telegraph. I got an email on my own private email address after I'd interviewed Sir Ranulph Fiennes. I mean, if you're going to interview anybody in the adventure world, he's one of them. And I had interviewed him for the Telegraph for an event that he was talking at. And I just so happened to tweet out this interview saying, feeling really inspired to go and climb some big mountains. And it was just after that tweet that I got in conversation with them, and they were just looking for someone with a beginner's kind of view of doing big mountain treks. And this was actually nearly, 3 years ago this began. This is how long we've been waiting for this trip to come about. And that kind of gives you some insight into how long we've been training for it, because you can't kind of take your foot off the ball, for want of a better phrase. We were originally due to go out in April 2020, and obviously we'd just gone into lockdown. We went into lockdown the week we were supposed to fly out, which was devastating because you put so much time and effort into the training of it. But looking back, I'm really grateful for the extra time, because we did manage to get into a much more of a habit and a much more healthy outdoor lifestyle before we went. We were cancelled, but on the day that we were cancelled in 2020, me and two of the other people who were on the team that we were trekking with decided that we would try and climb Everest on our staircase at home instead, and raise money in the process of it. Because it's like, you've done all this walking and all this training, we might as well do something to mark the occasion. So we did that in April 2020, and I got to base camp then, didn't make it to the top. One guy made it to the top, and he was like 20 minutes short of breaking the world record, which was just mental. I think I was going for 18 hours and he was going for like 24 hours or something. And after that, the trip was back on. We thought, right, this is it. We can put it back in the diary. We had to rearrange dates twice more. And then, finally got out there April 2022. And with regards to the amount of training, it is a beginner-friendly trek, really. Like, seeing some of the level of fitness and the type of people on the trail, you don't have to be like a serious athlete to do it. But the one thing I would say is, the fitter you are and the more preparation you've done, the more enjoyable the experience will be. You won't be huffing and puffing up the slope. You won't be in agony every night. So me and my partner did a lot of training up here in the Northwest in the Lake District. We did back-to-back day walking, so like 10 miles one day, 10 miles the next day, just to get used to the endurance. I did a lot of swimming to try and like increase like lung capacity. And then just like regular gym sessions, just to try and, I wanted to feel good when we got there, because it was one of those things, as long as I felt like I'd prepared as much as I could, if I didn't make it to base camp, it will have been because of something out of my control. And yeah, so we headed out there and we made it, and I felt great the whole way, pretty much. Not too many physical ailments to complain about, and it was a great group. We went quite fast, and I was, like I say, because of the training, was able to just take time walking and look around and just appreciate where you actually are in the world, because it's absolutely incredible out in the Himalayas.
Well, that's it, yeah. You know, going back to your point about making sure that you can actually enjoy it by training up enough that you're not huffing and blowing and collapsing. You want to be able to take in those views. You're in a really unique place, a place that many can only dream of going to. And interesting as well that you said you did swimming.
whether it is a scientifically proven thing, but a couple of people I'd spoken to were like, you might as well give it a go. And it was also from doing heavy day walkings to then go swimming, it's just easier on your body, but you were still doing a form of exercise one day. I also did, when I was in London, I visited the Altitude Centre and they do training sessions up to like 4,000 metres, like spinning classes and things like that. And we hired one of their kits and had it delivered home. So we ended up having a spinning bike in our kitchen and I'd sit there for an hour with a mask on, cycling at 5,000 metres. And that's to help with fitness, but also with the acclimatisation thing, because that's the biggest risk, really, the altitude. Despite all the skiing, the highest I had probably been beforehand was maybe over just over 3,000 skiing on some of the glaciers in the Alps. So the altitude was something that was the real risk of things going wrong. And there's mixed reports as to whether the altitude training actually helps. But I mean, I did it and I was fine. So whether you can put it down to that or what, we don't know. But for me, a big thing about doing the altitude training was the mental aspect of it. So I knew what it felt like to be out of breath at 5,000 metres. And I knew, don't panic, that's just the altitude. That's not something going wrong. It's just, this is how it feels to breathe at these type of altitudes. So that was what I found was really beneficial. The knowing that when I got there, if I did start to feel out of breath, it wasn't because there was something wrong with me. It was because there is just so much little oxygen in the air. So that's another tip for high altitude training that I thought was quite beneficial to us.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you sound a bit like me. I don't like that feeling of being out of breath. I'm an anxious person. So preparing yourself for that and like you say, telling yourself, oh, this is normal, this is how you're going to feel, just don't panic.
Yeah.
I think that's a really smart thing to do. And obviously it did help.
Well, yeah. When you're in the mountains like that, you are in such an extreme environment. There is so much to consider and think about. So I very much went in with the approach of you can't overthink these things, but I'm a very organized person and I'd like to be as prepared as possible. So I was like, if I can tick off all those things and prepare as much, it just puts your mind at rest. And again, you can just enjoy the experience whilst you're there.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about the experience then. So how long were you trekking for and how many were on your team and what was it like?
So the trip in total was 18 days and we spent 2 nights in Kathmandu at first. So we were on the trail, actually on our feet, for 14 days, I think. And we were in a group of, so it was me and my partner and 4 other trekkers. And we were, our team leader was Jamling Tenzing. And then we had 3 Sherpas with us. So that's quite a big Sherpa to client ratio. But like I say, it was like a kind of a trial run for the trek, one of the first treks that they'd run. So we were seeing how things were going. So in total, there were 10 of us. And yeah, we started off, we flew out of Kathmandu. We actually flew to Fat Ding rather than Lukla. So when everyone talks about the Everest Base Camp trek, they will always mention the flight into Lukla, into the Hilary Tenzing Airport, because it is the most dangerous and notorious landing strip in the world. So this is an airstrip that I think is about 80 metres in length. I don't know if that stat's right, but it feels 80 metres in length. And it actually runs up the side of the mountain. So it's on an incline. And so for them to land planes, and they're tiny little propeller planes, at this airport is really down to like the conditions that there can't be any wind, can't be any cloud, because if they can't see where they're going, they're going to hit the mountain behind it. And on the day we were due to fly out, that it was heavy cloud cover. So our flight was cancelled for 8 hours and we were sat in Kathmandu airport for this long. And eventually it was like, right, we're just going to have to get a helicopter, but we're going to bypass Lukla. We're going to go a bit higher and helicopter into Fat Ding. So in many respects, I'm quite a nervous flyer. So I was quite glad that we missed the Lukla flight. But then, and also we got to go in helicopter through the Himalayas, which is, it's common. Like that's what a lot of people end up having to do. So once we got to Fat Ding, we were then on our feet. So we were walking for about 7 days before we got to Everest Base Camp. And then after base camp, we went up to summit and climbed Lobuchi East, which is one of the Himalayan peaks, which face onto Everest. So after that, yeah, in total, it was about 14 days by the time we got back to Kathmandu.
That's amazing. See, people don't realise what's involved when you say you've done base camp Everest. No one really sort of gets how you get there, what's involved and all of that. So that's really interesting. And what was it like camping there and you know, having a hard day's walking and then having to sleep in a tent?
Well, it's actually really quite comfortable now. We only slept in a tent for one night, and that is most, the most common approach now. So back in the 90s, it was probably 90% of people stayed in tents all the way up to base camp, which I can only imagine how that must take so much out of you physically to not get a good night's sleep. Whereas the other way around now, it's probably more like 90 to 95% of people visiting stay in the lodges. So these are like little, the hotels pretty much run by the local people. And Namche Bazaar is the main town that you get to quite early in the trek. It's over 3,000 metres. You spend an acclimatisation day there normally. So we spent two nights there. The lodge there was brilliant. We had ensuite rooms, hot water, Wi-Fi. They all have a little restaurant communal area where you eat your meals. So it's actually quite comfortable. And there's bakeries and chocolate cake and cinemas and shops and this is down at Namche level. And as we got higher, the standards do dwindle a bit. Like you won't maybe get an ensuite room. You maybe have to pay for the Wi-Fi. You probably have to pay to charge your phone, things like that. But I was quite pleasantly surprised by the level of comfort. And would I have liked to have camped a bit more to get that like outdoorsy experience? Maybe. But again, it means your body's in a much better condition the next day. And with regards to how it felt after each day's walking, most days we weren't actually walking for longer than maybe 4 hours. It's like you'd set off super early, probably around 8 a.m., 9 a.m. And some of the days we were arriving at our next place, including a lunch stop, by 1, 2 p.m. So you've got the whole afternoon to relax and recover. But then that said, you're fast asleep and ready for bed at like 7 p.m. Like you are tired by the end of the days and it does take it out of you. But yeah, I was impressed with the comfort. I was impressed with how much time we got to relax. That also helps with your acclimatization. And the one night we did stay in a tent, it's testament to the local porters and Sherpas out there because the tents are all set up for you. And that's the given with most expeditions. Like very, very few people are doing it unassisted and carrying their own tents these days. And there was a nice little comfy mattress in there and they set up a food tent. These guys rely on tourists visiting and they're very welcoming and they're really appreciative. As long as people respect that part of the world who go out there and make a good connection with these local people and don't take them for granted because they are working very hard, then they seem to appreciate the business and the people coming and spending money and bringing new experiences to a part of the world which is completely cut off. Like there's no roads, they are cut off from the rest of the world. So by these trekkers, hundreds and thousands of them going every season, it's their lifeline, really.
Gosh, and I bet they've really suffered during the pandemic, haven't they, without that income?
Exactly. And I think the Nepali government last April, so 2021, they did reopen the border and they were granting trekking, well, more climbing permits than they did trekking. And they actually granted a record number of Everest climbing permits last year than any other year in history, which strikes you as odd considering we're in the middle of a pandemic. But that just shows how desperate they were to get some tourism back in the country because of how much it contributes to the local economies around there.
And all of these little towns that you stopped in on your way up, were they very touristy and geared towards tourists, or did you find that they were quite authentic and that you were very much immersing yourself in the local community?
So it's a mixture. So Lukla, where the airstrip is and the airport, they're obviously still traditional towns because the houses are built in traditional ways. But there are souvenir shops and barber shops and cafes and things. But they all looks, there's no flashing lights or any of this. It all looks very traditional. And Namche Bazaar, again, the biggest Sherpa town in the valley is big. But it's bright and colourful and lively, but we went to one of the bars on our final night before we flew home and the locals were just so happy to see you and you get such an authentic experience, even though it is obviously one of the bigger towns. There's cash points and all of that, but it doesn't feel overly intrusive. yet, and you'd hope that it does stay that way and it doesn't progress anything more than that. As you get higher, so we stayed in a village called Dingboche for 2 nights when we acclimatized, and also when we came back down from our climb, that felt a lot more local. So that was just over 4,000 meters at height, and there's a lot less going on. Their culture is potato farming, so we saw the people out with the horses dragging the plows, and there's not as much going on there. The shops are a lot smaller. It just feels a lot more remote, and there's less people speak English. And then again, as you got further higher up, when we stayed in Lubuche village, there's only one little tiny shop that wasn't even open when we were there. And you do, as you progress, you see how cut off and remote these places are, and you get a real sense for appreciation for the people who live there, and also for just how beautiful and magnificent that part of the world is.
Amazing. And is there anything to see which doesn't involve climbing or trekking in these areas, or is it very much honed in on the trekking and the climbing aspects?
Yeah, if you're not going to walk, you're going to struggle to get anywhere. That's one. But there are things, like a lot of people just go to Namche and don't go any further. Like at Namche, they've got the Tenzing Norgay Memorial from where you can see the view of Everest. And they also have a tiny museum there that you can see. And it's not always base camp that people are trekking to either. So from Namche, you can go other ways. You can do Gokyo, or you can do different routes from there because it's the national park as a whole. All eyes are pretty much on Everest Base Camp, but there is variety and other things to do. But yeah, if you're not going to trek or walk around, I think you'd be a little bit stuck.
Yes, it's not a chilled holiday location. We can say that for sure.
Not really, no. There's no swimming pools and hot tubs,
no,
that's for
stay
sure.
Away in that case then. So you mentioned to me when I was chatting to you about setting up this call, a lot of work happening to clean up base camp. Now, call me naive, but I would have assumed that any trekkers there would genuinely, you know, be the type to clean up and not leave any trace themselves behind. Is that not the case?
It's not necessarily the trekkers that we're talking about here. So it's quite a big story around the Everest cleanup and the rubbish that gets left behind on the mountains. And a lot of this originates with the local people. And I spoke quite candidly with Jamling Tenzing while we were out there about the issue. And his father was the first person to climb this mountain. And he says the issue comes from the Sherpas because they aren't educated to not throw litter and drop litter. So it's took time. They are educated now, but originally back in the 80s, 90s, when this mass tourism started kicking off, there was no knowledge about what impact leaving that amount of litter behind could do. So when Jamling and his team went in for the first time, they started introducing programs to encourage the Sherpas to bring down litter with them, and they get paid for it. But he also made a very valid point with regards to the visitors that go, and especially when they're on the high mountains and on Everest. For them, it's safety first when you're in the mountains. And if an occasion happens where it's a life or death situation, is your concern going to be picking up the oxygen bottle? I mean, it should be, but when it's life and death, what is the priority? And everyone was very honest in the fact, well, yeah, you've not really got much choice. But luckily now there is so much awareness about it. There's a charity called the SPCC, who are the pollution committee for the whole national park, and they are working incredibly hard to help people bring stuff back. And the attitude over there is really positive. Trekkers can now bring rubbish down with them. So what they do, it's incredible, the setup. The local porters bring it down to a recycling place at Namche Bazaar. The recyclable material gets shredded up into tiny shreds, and they put it into like little pouches, like 1 kilo pouches. So if you're already carrying 10 kilograms on your back, just to add another little pouch in there to carry it back down, then it goes and gets recycled properly. It's incredible the amount of stuff they can move that quickly if people volunteer to do it. And yeah, there is a lot of waste that can't be recycled or moved away. It's sad. There's dead bodies on Everest that they can't move. And there's a lot of effort going in to try and tidy it up. But it's a mindset change for the locals that is happening. And it's brilliant to see. And it's also a trekker thing, like you say, to make sure we're still aware that you can't leave rubbish behind. And there are fines if expeditions don't bring back all their waste and things like that. But it's a really interesting topic. And since I've started writing about it, people have a lot of opinion about it. And it it's hard to have a solution, but the work that's going on already is really positive. And it's nice to be able to think, actually, I've just come and appreciated and walked this trek. If I can now help by taking some litter away with me, then why wouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. That's really interesting. And sadly, this is the case everywhere and in a lot of ski resorts as well. As you all know, shrinking glaciers, the impact really, which is probably more so because thousands, millions of people go to ski resorts, you know, and leave rubbish behind, smoke,
yeah,
burn energy that, you know, goes towards melting the glaciers. So you wrote a piece in the Telegraph about overnight mountaineers ruining Everest. What did you mean by that?
So I was on the trip with Jamling Tenzing. So he's the son of Tenzing Norgay Sherpa, who climbed Everest first time 70 years ago, next year it'll be, with Sir Edmund Hillary. And I got to spend a lot of time one-on-one with Jamling, and it was just, you can't take that opportunity and not make the most of it. So we had some really candid discussions about the litter issue, but also about the people who are now climbing Everest and visiting Everest. And it was really refreshing to speak to someone who's obviously quite a public figure, has quite a big legacy. And he spoke very honestly about the people who are going. And the overnight mountaineers thing was how he referred to some of the people who are going, paying an extortionate amount of money just to go and climb Everest and be able to say, I've stood on top of the world. And sometimes these people don't have the mountain experience. They've never really used crampons or done any big mountains before, but because they've got the money to go, they are, to quote him, overnight mountaineers, and they're getting pulled up there and they are achieving brilliant things. I mean, you can't take away from the fact that they do make it up there, but there is a lot of pressure and a lot of work goes on behind the scenes with the Sherpa community and the people who do all the work to help them get up there. So yeah, he talked quite honestly about that. And again, it provoked some really good conversation about whether, how can you control the numbers on Everest? How could you stop there being so many people on there? I'm sure everyone will have seen some of the pictures over the past few years where there's just queues to the summits, and that's 300 plus people. And you're stood at an altitude where it's a deadly level of altitude. If you run out of oxygen at that height, you're literally putting your life on the line. And there's questions about limiting the number of permits that they can issue each year, increasing the cost. And unfortunately, I think Jamling's opinion was that neither of those seem like they're going to happen anytime soon, because like we've just said, the Nepal government make a lot of money from these permits. It keeps a lot of people in business and in jobs. So yeah, I don't know if there really is a solution to that, but it's definitely a different approach to mountaineering than it was when his father was alive and when Everest first became a big hotspot, because it is a hotspot. And I saw that firsthand get into base camp in real life.
Yeah, it's a tough one, isn't it? It's money versus sustainability.
Exactly.
When you come down to it. And, you know, I've been in parts of the world such as Maya Bay in Thailand, which obviously brings a lot of money to that area. But of course, they did decide to close it a few years ago and let, you know, nature restore itself there. But it is very much that money versus sustainability. And we have to come up with ways not to have that argument to benefit both.
Yeah, and it's also sustainability, but also safety at those heights. And I received a press release this week about the number of mountain rescues that have had to be operated in the Himalayas this season. And that is one thing that quite shocked me, is the amount of helicopters flying in and out. Like, I live in quite a remote part of the UK, and I'm lucky if I get a bus every 2 hours. I mean, there was a helicopter every 10 minutes coming in and out of base camp when we were there. And yeah, they're flying in supplies and things, but a lot of the time they're flying in climbers, they're taking people down. And it is just, I think Jamling's concern with a lot of his comments is, if you're not prepared and you're not experienced enough, you put your life on the line by being in those environments without the proper skill and with that many people.
Yeah, absolutely. And money can buy you a lot of things, but it cannot buy you the preparation that you've done to climb a mountain at the end of the day. And that's it. It doesn't matter how much money you have. If you're not prepared, then we've seen it. We've unfortunately seen bodies being left up there. Really interesting.
It really is. And I've now read and watched, so there's so many films out there about it and so many books out there about it, and it's not a new topic.
Absolutely it is. And I think that social media, Instagram in particular, makes people numb to those sorts of experiences and what's really involved, because they see a pretty picture, or they see all kinds of people doing it. And you've been vlogging about the experience, haven't you? You've sort of documented it.
I have. And I've never really got into the world of vlogging before, but I thought, well, this is a once in a lifetime trip. I had so many people, and since I've got back, so many people like asking questions that I was like, well, I had these questions before I went. And if I can at least just share a bit of an honest first time of view on this, well, I might as well vlog. And it was also more from a journalistic point of view. I found it easier just to record something every day rather than sit there at night where your hands are freezing and you can't take your gloves off, writing notes or just talking to camera or recording voice notes was an easier way to document the experience. But yeah, I've done a series of vlogs just to try and give a bit of a look of this is what it's like every day. I surprise myself with some days how I don't sound out of breath, and then the next day I am out of breath. It's just a nice way to look back at it, really, and try and give an honest view, which I hope it does. And it's hard to make it not look beautiful, though, because it is beautiful. And I want people to see that side of it, but just be prepared when you go there, because you'll enjoy it for the more if you do.
Amazing. So what have you got coming up next, Lucy? Any more big adventures, or are you still recovering from this one?
I think we've only just got back down to earth, if I'm honest. It took us a couple of weeks just to decompress and get back to sea level way of thinking. And it's actually quite tricky. We are in discussion to potentially hopefully go back in a couple of years and climb another mountain. I just think it's one of those things, once you've done it once, it's hard to find that type of adrenaline and that type of thrill, especially if you're the type of person I am who it likes that type of fun where it's actually really, really hard, but there is this enjoyment out the other end of it. But that's a long way off. I'm looking forward to next ski season now, really. Just go and ski. Hopefully everything will be open. Spend the winter in the snow and the mountains and I'll be happy.
Yeah, absolutely. Skiing will be a doddle after that, won't it?
Yeah, hopefully.
Oh, amazing. Well, Lucy, it's been fantastic talking to you. Really, really interesting. And you've made me want to go and do Everest now, but we'll see how I get on with the Inca Trail first. And
yeah,
go from
exactly.
There.
That's good prep. It's very good preparation. The more hours you spend on your feet, the better. That's the only way you can prepare, really.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for coming on.
You're welcome.